Hey everybody, Tom Lounge is here. Time for another edition of Midwest Beat, a program all about music and the people who make it. Tonight I got a very special guest joining us, Mr. Leland Sklar. He's an iconic bassist, session player, live touring musician, and now a founding member of the Immediate Family, a new supergroup whose brand new album will be spotlighted tonight as we talk to Leland about his career on being one of the go-to session players in the music business for the last several decades. They've got some great music together, and we'll be talking all about the Immediate Family. You're invited to this family reunion on Midwest Beat right after your headlines. Hey everybody, Tom Lounge is here, and we have got a great show for you tonight. This is Midwest Beat, a show all about music and the people who make it. Tonight, my guest is Leland Sklar. Leland is a legendary bassist who has worked on probably most of the albums that you have in your collection, and certainly many of the songs that you have grown up to as the soundtrack of your life. He's also a co-founding member of the Immediate Family. They're a unique group of iconic musicians who have played together for decades in sessions and on the road, and now they're together with their own album. And we're going to play something from it before we get Leland on the phone to talk to you and me about this amazing new group and his historic career. Let's start off with what is their new single. This is The Immediate Family and Divorced.
Tell me why do we have to sink like a stone? You leave somebody
New music, new single, Divorce. That's the Immediate Family. A supergroup, if you will, of some great session and touring musicians who have been part of our soundtrack of life for the last several decades. My guest tonight is Leland Sklar. He is the bassist and a co-founder of the Immediate Family, and a guy that I had the good fortune of saying hello to and shaking his hand many, many years ago when he was on the road with John Denver, and we were producing some shows with him at the old Star Plaza Theater. And I do believe he's with us. Leland, are you on the phone?
I'm on the phone, and I was just really digging listening to Divorce. Cooch wrote such a great song there, and it's just it really just pictures everything that so many people have gone through. It's pretty amazing.
I love the line, like, how are we going to tell mom and dad and the kids? And, you know, it's one of those things that you do think about. Sometimes you have to put them before you making that tough decision.
And
many of us have been down that road, and it's not an easy thing. But how is that single doing? I mean, it is a topical song that we all can relate to in some ways.
I think it's doing really well, and the video for it is really great. And we just released that, and it's been an adventure, I'll tell you, working, doing this band, you know, to be pretty much every time we get together, I'm looking at guys I've been looking at for 50 years and still digging them. So it's a unique situation for sure.
It's got to be, you know, and bands many times when they break up, it is like a divorce. And you guys, as you said, have been together for so long. You are absolutely family in so many ways. And after all the decades of recording together on session after session and going out on the road together, in, you know, different incarnations, why now to officially become a band? And I know you kind of did that in the early 70s with The Section, which I do want to touch on, but this seems more like a real band.
Yeah, well, what happened, a brief explanation of where this came from, was Danny Korchmar got a record deal with a Japanese label called Vivid Records a few years back. And when it came time to fulfill his obligation to do an album for the label, and what they wanted him to do was do an album pretty much of the songs that he'd been involved with people like Don Henley and, you know, all these different artists, James Taylor, that he had co-written songs with or written songs for. On a whim, he called myself and Russ Kunkel to see if we would be available, kind of assuming we were probably not going to be, because it was at a time of year where normally we would have been on tour.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a perfect window, because it was only going to be about 4 days in the studio, 3 or 4 days. And he had just moved back to the West Coast from the East Coast shortly before that, and had hooked up with Steve Postel. They lived near each other, and through mutual friends, they hooked up. And Steve was helping Cooch doing pre-production and things like this for the album. So we went in the studio. He wanted Waddy Wachtel to also be involved, but Waddy was out with Stevie Nicks. And but he was home for the last day of recording, so he came in. And we finished the album and then went to Japan to promote it. And the Japanese wanted to know, you know, what are we going to call this album? It's Danny Korchmar, and what do you want to call it? And Danny thought about it, and he said, well, look, if these guys are like my immediate family, so let's just call it Danny Korchmar and the Immediate Family. And that's how the Japanese connection was established. When we finished the tour in Japan, we all kind of looked at each other and said, why aren't we doing this? I mean, you know, continuing this on. And we signed with a record label in the States called Quarto Valley Records. This guy, Bruce Quarto, it's his label, and he really fell for the band. And so we are signed with them. And at that point, then we just dropped the Danny Korchmar, and it just was the Immediate Family, and it's kind of like a democratic society now.
Okay.
But we've had just the greatest time, because we know each other so well. I mean, the youngster in the band is Steve Postel, and I think the first time I worked with Steve was about 15 years ago. But he's kind of the newbie on the block with us. But it's been really one of these things that we've never had words between us or anything. It's really been friendships. And you hear about so many of these groups that, you know, it's just volatile and they have nothing but grief. You know, they do the gigs, but they never want to see each other or travel together. And we really all love each other's company and we really get on great. So it's kind of a, you know, we had certain plans, but the pandemic, you know, caused certain issues to come up like it did for everybody else. The time frame of things we wanted to do, the promotional stuff, because the album that we're promoting at this point was finished before the pandemic.
Okay.
And then all of the things that we had lined up to do all were gone. So
was the Japanese tour, was that post-pandemic or pre?
The first tour that kind of got it all together happened, and it was great. Then we were supposed to go back, and that tour got canceled, which would have been this year. And also we were supposed to do, we had done like the last live gig we played. Was February of last year, and it was the Rock Legends cruise that sailed from Fort Lauderdale to the Grand Caymans and back. And then we were supposed to do the next one, too, and that got canceled because of COVID. So now we're booked for February of next year to do that tour again.
Third time's a charm.
Yeah, well, it's one of these things. And also, but the thing that's been really wonderful about all of this is during an incredibly dark, horrid time in our history, there has been some light in it. And we've just kept working and working. We've been in the studio cutting more songs for next year. Mm-hmm. We've been involved with Denny Tedesco, who made the movie The Wrecking Crew about the studio musicians of the 60s in Los Angeles. He's doing a documentary film about us.
Excellent.
Which is being edited at this point. We've during the course of the pandemic, we finished the filming that had to be done and did all of our videos, but we were doing our videos individually. And then we have a guy named Michael Perlmutter, who is a video editor, and he's put all this stuff together. We just make pieces and send them to him. So it's been really a creative, busy time, but not exactly what we would have imagined it being, you know, pre-pandemic.
Now, you're on the road now, correct? You're touring now?
Yeah, we just finished three shows in Los Angeles, which, God, knock on wood, all three of them sold out. And we leave on Friday for the East Coast, and we have about 12 days of work back there.
What size venues are you guys doing at this point?
I think they were like, you know, 500 to 700 seats. You know, that kind of thing, like a theater.
Mm-hmm.
We played the Libero Theater up in Santa Barbara, and we played the Coach House down here and Canyon Club. And now the Canyon Club, the guy who owns it loved it, and he's booked us. I think he has three Canyon Clubs, so he just booked us for December to do another show at one of the other ones. But, you know, we're building a brand, because the thing that's hard about this is, as individuals, we all have reputations in this industry for what we've done. But building the name, the immediate family, it takes time, because it was like when we did the Rock Legends cruise. We were on the ship and people would come up and go, "Man, what are you doing here? Who are you playing with?" And we would say, "The immediate family." They go, "Who's that?" You know, it's kind of like, you know, introducing people to
right.
us.
Right.
And so far everything's going great. I mean, I have no complaints about this. We're enjoying ourselves. The label's happy, and the audiences have been really great, and they're really happy, and the promoters. So we'll just keep at it. We're going to keep flogging until they send us out to pasture, I guess.
Well, hopefully that's not going to happen for a while. No,
I hope so.
In addition to doing the dates that you just talked about, you were also, we were talking with Lisa, the publicist, about setting this up for about a week or so ago, and she says, "Sorry, guys are busy. They're working with Carole King at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame." And I said, "Well, I guess I'll have to take second seat to that." what was that all about? Tell us a little about working with her.
Well, I mean, you know, when we started with James Taylor, which was really kind of where all of our careers began, was pivotal around James in 1970. The original band for James Taylor was Danny Korchmar, Russ Kunkel, myself, and Carole King was the piano player in the group. And we encouraged, you know, in the early tours that, because people really didn't know who Carole was. They, you know, people in the industry knew who Goffin and King were because they right. were a hugely successful songwriting team. And it was Carole and Jerry Goffin, her husband. But in our shows, we started encouraging Carole to, like, you know, open the show, you know, play some of your songs, you know, let people know who you are. And eventually she goes in the studio and cuts Tapestry. So, yeah, needless to say, she had to leave at that point because it's pretty hard to have a side person in the band who has the biggest record in the world.
Right.
So she left, and that's when I had done a project with Craig Berge and brought him in to replace her, and that's where the section formed out of all of that. But so our relationship with Carole goes back to those early days, and she called and she said, would Russ and myself and Cooch come back to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for her induction, and we could play You've Got a Friend. And it was great. It was wonderful. I mean, it's an accolade so well deserved. She's already in it as a songwriter with Jerry Goffin, but this time they brought her in as an artist, a solo artist. And it was really exciting. She was just beaming through the whole thing. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. So we did that, came back, and then I just finished doing a couple of more episodes sitting in on the Kelly Clarkson show with the band, and got Kelly to do You've Got a Friend. She sang that and Another Day in Paradise on one of the other shows. And just trying to stay. It's been a period where everything pretty much turned into Plan B. Because mm-hmm. Our Plan A just went out the window like everybody else. And so it's been an interesting period to kind of discover alternative ways of being creative and doing what we love. And now it's starting to slip back into being what we really love to do. But, you know, you got to be real careful with this because there's been a lot of tours going out that have had to shut down again because of somebody got COVID within it. And,
right.
You know, so trying to be, you know, very cognizant and really want to do, you know, events that are put together properly with, you know, people being vaccinated and masked and everything. Because the last thing we want to do is backslide into this kind of, you know, weird oblivion we've been in for the past almost 2 years.
Right. But at least you've kept busy. You guys have accomplished a lot at a time when most people were sitting home playing video games or doing virtual concerts.
Yeah.
So kudos to you for that.
Yeah, we've been really, and I did like a ton of, I did a lot of things I never dreamed of doing a YouTube channel, recording from home, doing all kinds of stuff. So it's actually been some of the busiest I've been in for almost forever. But it was all stuff that was never planned. Because all the work I had in the book come through, you know, and not been canceled because of COVID, I wouldn't have done any of these other things because there wouldn't have been time.
Right,
It's been fascinating. It's fascinating to me.
Well, let's play another song for my listeners from the Immediate Family album. What would you like to play?
Oh, God. Surprise me.
All right.
Surprise me.
Yeah. I'm torn.
I like them all. I mean, I really love the album. I don't, you know, it's so nice to be involved in something where you kind of go, yeah, there's a couple of great tunes and then some filler.
What's nice is they shift sounds, too. I mean, it's not like it's cut from the same cheesecloth. I mean, the sounds here reflect all the different influences and the fact that all of you guys are leaders of bands in so many ways. I mean, you're all just so huge in your own right that it affects the sound and the songs here. We're going to talk a bit about songwriting, but I'm torn between two songs right now, and that is A Thing of the Past and Fair Warning. Completely different sounding tunes. Of those two, what would you like?
Let's go with Fair Warning.
Okay, sounds good.
Pick some serious butt.
Yeah, I love the beginning of this, too. All right, we'll be talking with Leland right after this. Stay with me on Midwest Beat, Lakeshore Public Radio. New music. Fair Warning's the song, The Immediate Family is the album and the band, and these are the guys that provided the soundtrack to our wayward youth. All of us grew up listening to some great albums, and I'll tell you, most of the guys you're hearing on these songs have been on those albums. If you grew up reading the liner notes, as I did, I'd rush home from the record store, put my cans on my head, lay on the bed and read the liner notes, and that's how I heard of these incredible musicians, Danny Kortchmar, Russ Kunkel, Waddy Wachtel, and Leland Sklar. Now, Leland is our guest tonight. Now, Leland, I don't know much about Steve. He is the newbie, as you said. Tell me a little about Steve and how he fits in with the resumes of you guys.
Well, the thing that's nice with Steve is he adds just another dimension to it. The thing that's fun with the band is it's three guitar players who really do not step on each other's toes. Stylistically, they really balance each other. And vocally, because on Fair Warning, the main vocal on that one is Waddy singing. Okay. On Divorced, it's mainly Cooch, but Steve has really a beautiful tenor voice, so he's also blending in with all of this. I worked with him on a solo album of his, like I said, about 15 years ago, and I used to do gigs around Los Angeles with him. And he's worked with David Crosby and Kenny Loggins and Jennifer Warnes. He's done movie scores, and he has a pretty, you know, comprehensive studio at his house, and we did a lot of the work on the album at his house. And he's a good engineer. So it was one of these things where the four of us really have this incredible history of a half a century together of touring and recording. And Steve just, it seemed to be this other element that fit in really nicely in it. It was kind of effortless getting him kind of up to speed with us. Now, if you're going to look at discographies and things like that, he's not in the same position as the rest of us because he's about 10 years, you know, behind us in terms of work.
Mm-hmm.
But we were so lucky, man. We hit that kind of golden age of this business in 1970. So that when James Taylor hit, and he really was like the perfect artist for something new to happen in music, that we were there to kind of ride the crest of that wave with him. And all of a sudden, I think one of the great advantages that we had was, and we owe so much to Peter Asher, who produced and managed James, who was part of Peter and Gordon back in the English Invasion days.
He's been on the show with me. I had a chance to work with him a couple of times. What a great guy and the stories he's got.
His stories are unbelievable. I've done his one-man show with him a number of times, and I kind of sit there every time going, I didn't know that. I didn't know that one either. He comes up with new stuff all the time. But one of the things that was amazing was when we started working with James, he insisted that our names appear on the album jacket, where the Wrecking Crew and all those people, you know, when people were listening to the Mamas and the Papas and you know, Frank Sinatra and the Beach Boys and stuff back in the 60s, didn't realize that it was kind of the same bunch of studio musicians playing on all those records.
Mm-hmm.
They were quite anonymous. So when Peter put our names on it and the labels started signing singer-songwriters, they would look at James's album and say, God, you know, if we could only be as good as James. Well, let's hire those guys and see, you know. So that's how we ended up, you know, working with Jackson Browne and Linda Ronstadt, Warren Zevon, and, you know, just countless artists. And I was fortunate that I came from a background as a from childhood as a classical pianist. So I was a really strong reader. So as our names got around, I started getting hired for all kinds of other things, movies and television and more legit projects where you had to be a reader to do them and not just a player.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, you know, I kind of pinch myself every day and realize how, you know, I've worked really hard, but I've also been very fortunate. And I feel real fortunate that after all this time that I'm still sharing a stage with some of the favorite players I've ever worked with.
Let's focus on you for a minute individually. You are a Midwesterner. You were born in Wisconsin, correct?
Milwaukee.
We
moved to Los Angeles when I was going on 5 years old. So okay. L.A. really is it. But, you know, I do feel those roots when I get back there.
How did you come to music? What was the impetus for you to say, I think I'll try my hand at piano? Was it something the parents pushed on you? Was it something you gravitated to? And at the same time, when did you decide that piano wasn't the instrument for you?
Well, I'll tell you, I owe everything to Liberace. My parents used to watch his show on television when I was, you know, like 4 years old, and I would sit and watch it with them, and for some reason it connected with me. I just thought the kind of panache that he had, the music he played, because he was a fine pianist beyond kind of, and it wasn't all shtick at that point with him. I mean, he was wearing a tuxedo and stuff. It wasn't like the Vegas show where he came out and drove a Rolls Royce onto stage and came out in furs and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But I was really enamored with piano, and we had a baby grand piano. The family had a piano. My mom played a little bit, but nobody was really a serious pianist in the family, but we did have this piano. And I started, after watching that show, I started playing and plunking around on it, and my folks realized that I had an affinity towards it and found me a teacher. And by the time I think I was 8 years old, I had won some awards from the Hollywood Bowl Association.
Wow.
And was doing recitals like every month. And it was, I loved it, but it was also an incredible amount of pressure. So when I got into junior high school, when I was 12 years old, I kind of assumed you're piano players here, kind of an attitude. And the music teacher, his name was Ted Lynn, he said, "We have about a dozen kids playing piano right now. We need a string bass player." And he pulled out this old K upright out of the back room. And I said, handed it to me. I said, "I'll try it." And as soon as I held that thing and I plucked a note on it and felt that vibration run down through my body, I just looked at him and I said, "I'd love to do this." And fell in love with the bass at that point. And at that point, I was kind of just burned with piano. I mean, I had gotten very good, but I was weary of it. And so to have a new challenge and something like bass, really resonated with me. And as time went on, I just fell in love with the position that bass holds within musical, most all genres. Mm-hmm. But that whole element of you really are kind of the liaison between rhythm and melody, working with drums and then lead instruments, piano, guitar, or orchestral work, things like that. And the weird part of the whole thing, though, is Liberace was from Milwaukee.
Oh, wow. I never knew that.
He and I are both in the Wisconsin Musicians Hall of Fame. So, you know, it's like this giant weird circle.
Wow.
That I traveled.
When we just played Fair Warning, you definitely get the groove factor. I was trying to think of, the lineup. I mean, the musicality of this group reminds me a lot of The Band, where everybody was just this stellar, incredible musician. And you guys are very comparable, in my opinion, to that. Of course, they started out backing Dylan and Robbie, and Hawkins and all those guys as the Hawks, and went on and found their own place. It took them not as long as you guys. You guys have been doing this a long time behind the scenes. But it's there seems to be a comparison there, only you guys have more of an R&B groove to your music as opposed to them having a little more of a country feel.
Yeah, I take this as a profound compliment because I was such a huge fan of the band, and I got to do some gigs with Levon and with Garth, and I love those guys. They were a remarkable group of musicians. I think the thing was we've all been busy for decades. We never really... Each of us has looked for other things. I was in a band called Barefoot Servants in the 90s that I had high hopes for, which was a killer band, but nothing came of it. Throughout the years, you know, we've all kind of longed for something to happen, but we were always busy. I've been busy touring with Phil Collins since the mid-'80s, and toured with, Russ and I have toured with Lyle Lovett. I think we're going out again this summer with him, and all kinds of separate projects. So this was the first time we actually really had an opportunity, because of Danny's record deal, to seriously look at doing something. And it just felt so good that we just went, this is really stupid. If we don't take advantage of this now, we're never going to get to do it. Kind of really regardless of how this ends up, the joy of just being together. And also at this age, so many of the bands of this generation and our age that have been around for a while, like when they're out touring, they're kind of like nostalgia tours. They're doing like their hits from the 80s and things like that. The thing that I think is so valid about this group is it's all, you know, we're working on new material and still moving forward. We're not a nostalgia band by any means. This is really aggressively pursuing writing and performing and bringing new music to people. And the old stuff that we still incorporate things like Waddy was, you know, co-writer on Werewolves of London with Warren Zevon. And we do like All She Wants to Do is Dance and Dirty Laundry, which Cooch wrote with Don Henley. And so we incorporate some of that into the set. When we first began, like Cooch would go up and tell the audience, we're a cover band that only plays original.
I like that.
Yeah, it was perfect, you know. Because,
now, with this band, what is the writing process like within the group? Since you all have writing credentials, you've all played on hit records, you all, again, are band leaders in your own right. How do you maintain the democratic groove of the writing, of the picking your parts and the arrangements? Do you bring in an outside source, an outside producer to kind of coach and referee a little bit?
No. It's actually that there's so much history and respect amongst everybody that there really is no issues with that. Like if Waddy's working on a tune, he might be working on a tune with Steve, or you know, Steve and Cooch might work on something, or songs are presented in a certain form, and then we all work on it. But we've played together for so long on the road and in the studio that they do take shape pretty quickly. And it's real interesting that some of the songs, when they do come in, are quite different than how they end up. But that's because everybody really has an equal say as to, you know, what's going to happen in the song. Ideas are thrown out, you know, all over the place. And pretty quickly, they become really cohesive and the stuff comes together. And we're fortunate in the studio because we've been working with Nico Bolas as our engineer. And we've all worked with Nico for decades, too. And he's a fantastic engineer. So things, you know, the minute we get in the studio, things just settle in. And we've been recording in Jackson Brown's studio. He has a studio out in Santa Monica. And during the pandemic, once we all had our shots, we really didn't do anything until everybody was vaccinated. We didn't want to take any chances. But once we did, we went in the studio. I think we were in the studio for 4 or 5 days, and I think 15 more songs for another album next year.
Okay.
So the process is ongoing. Just because things have been held up by COVID doesn't mean that we're waiting in the wings. We're really pushing the envelope constantly with new ideas and new directions with it. And it's really invigorating. I feel, you know, just pumped every day knowing I'm going to get to play with these guys.
With the tour going on now, with the album out, and you seem to be getting great reviews and great kudos from everybody, both fan-wise and critic-wise. Mm-hmm. And you're talking already recording a second album, you're working on stuff, you clearly sound happy, and I'm assuming the other guys are too. What does that say for the session work? Are you guys going to like say, well, well, maybe we won't be as available to sit in with so-and-so. We're focusing on us now. What do you think?
Well, I think everything is going to be predicated on schedule, what's going on. During the course of this whole period of building all this stuff, when the pandemic began, normally, like if people wanted me to record something from home for them, I would call up friends of mine who had home studios, and I would tell the people, look, send me files, and I'll see what I can do, and go to the friend's house and do it in their studios. And it was an excuse for us to go out and eat pizza or something like that, too.
Right.
With the advent of COVID, nobody was seeing each other. Nobody was going to each other's houses or anything like that. And a friend of mine in Los Angeles named Gussie Miller got together with some people, and they wanted to do a cover of Easy Lover, Phil Collins, Philip Bailey. And they said, we'd love for you to play on it. And I said, I'd love to do it, but I can't because I've never recorded at all. I don't know what the hell to do. Well, he had a friend at SSL, and they ended up sending me an SSL 2+ interface. And I contacted Steve Postel from the band, and I had him do a phone tutorial on GarageBand for me. And I ended up doing the bass part for this track and stuff, and I ended up putting it on my YouTube channel, and we've had about 600,000 views of it.
Wow.
And so I suddenly got very comfortable doing recording from home, and I've done probably during the course of the pandemic probably about 15 albums from people in New Zealand, Finland, Argentina, Ireland, all kinds of stuff. I'm working on a project with Ian Pace from Deep Purple.
Okay.
So I don't have any intention of slowing any of that down. I just keep adding to the equation. But, you know, certainly the immediate family is the priority. But if we're not doing anything, even for a day, I'm going to try to fill it with something else. And that's like when I started this by accident, this YouTube channel that I've been doing. Today was like my 760th something video since March of last year. I haven't missed a day since March of last year. And that's been great. And I formed a clubhouse in that. And have all kinds of stuff going on with that. I did a book. it's been crazy, and I really don't want to slow down. I'm going to, you know, incorporate as much as I possibly can. And I love, just like the other guys, I love studio work.
Mm-hmm.
And Russ and Cooch and Waddy and I just finished doing two albums with Susanna Hoffs from the Bangles.
I love her.
Yeah, this album. It's actually, we cut, I think, 16 or 17 songs. So it's actually going to be two albums. And she's singing great. She is such a delight to be around. The same team, and that's Peter Asher producing that, and the same team did Kate Taylor's album earlier in the year. So we all still love being creative with other people, too. So, you know, we're going to just keep pushing as hard as we can at this point and make the most out of every day.
Well, I didn't know Peter was still that active. I saw him on his one-man show when they played Acorn Theater. I think you were there for that. But he was, like I said, he seemed to be a little more kind of getting ready to retire. That was the impression I got from him. This was like a last hurrah going out with the British Invasion memory show and things like that. But I didn't realize he was still that active.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, they're doing another British Invasion show. He's still producing, and he does a lot of stuff. He's involved with Hans Zimmer.
Hmm.
So Peter, you know, Peter's really, you know, the thing with all of us is I think it's our DNA. It's really, when you start to look at alternative things, we all have skills in other areas, but when the decision has to be made, the thing that's first and foremost is we love making music together, and any opportunity that comes along to do it, really, we just jump on it.
Right. Right. You mentioned Kate Taylor. Are you guys working, or is anyone working with either Ben Taylor or Sally Taylor? I had them on the show a couple of years ago, and I've not heard anything from them.
I saw Ben a couple of years ago. Born a couple of years ago when we were doing the James Taylor, Carole King Troubadour reunion tour. Ben hung out with us for a while. I don't think anybody in this group is doing anything with Ben or Sally. Not that I wouldn't if they called, but you know, it also gets to the point where they're of an age where it's really best for them to be working with you know people their own age,
right,
on these projects. But you know, that being said, you know, when we were doing Phil Collins' tour, his son Nicholas was playing drums with us, and when we started the tour, he was 16 and wow. Killing it. He's a monstrously great drummer.
Wow!
And he's out with Genesis right now.
You mentioned the book a couple of times. Let's talk about the book.
Yeah. Okay.
What's the book all about, and what are you covering?
The book is called Everybody Loves Me, and it's a big coffee table book. It's a 6-pound huge book with 6,000 photographs in it of everybody imaginable giving me the finger.
I love it.
I mean, it's just one of the funniest things. Everybody who's seen it and has it just goes, it's our favorite thing. It sits on our coffee table, and everybody that comes in that starts looking and it goes nuts, because it's everybody from, you know, Phil Collins and Jackson Browne and James Taylor and Bonnie Raitt and Jeff Beck and Charlie Watts and Jay Leno, but it's everybody I've crossed paths with over the years. And the impetus for this was when I was on the road with Phil Collins doing the first Final Farewell tour in 2004, there was some talk that Phil was thinking about retiring at the end of the tour.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, you know, there was like 100 crew people. It was a massive production. And I thought, so many of these people are from, you know, UK, Europe, other parts of America, that I may never see them again if he retires, because that's what brings us all together. And I thought, I'm going to take pictures of everybody and just make a folder and put it away. I had a bass tech who I had all kinds of running gags with for the whole tour, named Steve Winstead. His nickname was Chinner. And so towards the end of the tour, he was sitting at his laptop working, and I went over with my camera and I said, "Hey, Chinner, give me a smile." And he did, without batting an eye, he didn't look up at all, just raised his hand and gave me the finger. And I look at the picture and I went, "Ooh, that's kind of cool, actually." So I went and I got Phil, I got Tony Smith, his manager, I got all the people in the band, all the crew, the caterers, truck drivers, bus drivers, had about 150 pictures, I guess. And then I tucked it away like I said I was going to do. And then a couple of years later, I ended up going on the road for the first time with Toto. And I thought, I'm going to do the same thing with these guys. I'd known those guys since before they were Toto. Steve Lukather and I have been friends since he was 19 years old.
Hmm.
And so I got all those people. It started to take on a life of its own. And actually, at this point, I have probably close to 13,000 pictures of everybody imaginable, from the man on the street, the woman on the street. I would get whole compartments on planes to all flip me off. Whole audiences at concerts, and there's nothing mean-spirited in this.
Right.
It's just really fun. And the thing is, it's not so much the fingers in there. There's a finite amount of ways of giving the finger. The faces are infinite, and so it runs the whole gamut of really aggressive faces to people that are covering their faces and everything. And it starts off, the first couple of pages are all babies giving the finger, and then it gets into little kids, and then there's certain themes that go through the whole thing. But there's, you know, like Jack Nicholson and Gwyneth Paltrow, and whenever I find myself in a situation, I kind of just tell these people, "Come on, flip me off," and they kind of go, "What?" I flip them off, and they go, "Well, okay." But my parents are in there. One of my favorite pictures is I did the Grammys a few years ago with Chris Christopherson, Merle Haggard, and Willie Nelson. And I got the three of them all giving me the finger together in there. So it's a whimsical book, and it's just meant for fun and to put a smile on your face. And I've sold, so far I've sold, I think, about 3,000.
Wow. Now, where can we get this?
And I'm doing it all myself. I mean, I sign them, I mail them. I mean, it's all me. So it's been a challenge for sure.
Well, how do we get this? I want to get a copy for myself, and I'm sure our listeners are going to want to check this out now too.
Here's what happened was I had to create a website for it. So I was going to get LelandSklar.com. Somebody owns that. Wow. Then I went to look at leesklar.com. Somebody owned that. And I think there's people grab these things and they just figure at some point you may need it and then they can stick it to you.
Right.
And I thought, hell with that. So I checked and LelandSklarsBeard.com was available. So if you go to LelandSklarsBeard.com, the book is there. I also have T-shirts there that have my beard on the front of the T-shirts, and I get all these people buying shirts, and then they send me pictures of them
wearing
walking
your
around
shirt
with my beard. And wow. I was an art major in college, so I've got a whole bunch of my illustrations and paintings are available on that also. So they can go to the website and preview it all and see what's
there. I just signed on here at LelandSklarsBeard.com. And, yeah, there's some cool stuff here. I see the pictures you're talking about and some of the getting flipped off pages here. Listeners, check it out. It's definitely cool. And you can get it signed. You can get it not signed, however you want it, whatever floats your boat. Lee will take care of you on that. What have we not covered, if anything, that you want to let people know? Because we are running tight on time. I'll slip in one more song.
More than anything, I just hope more and more opportunities open up for us to tour and really get out and do some serious touring around the country, around the world. And just we want to bring our music to everybody because we're having so much fun. It's something we want to share.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make as much music as I can. And, there's lots of other things going on. I mean, I could talk for ages about this because we're turning a bunch of the book into NFTs and making trading cards and stuff.
Right.
But right now, the focus of this call really is the immediate family. And I just want people to, if they want, come to check out our YouTube channel and subscribe to it would be great. And you could come to my YouTube channel too and subscribe to that because I'm there every day on it, showing songs I've worked on, talking about sessions, and a lot of the stuff I play along with and show the bass parts and stuff. I'm feeling really kind of a second childhood coming in. They talk about you get to a certain age.
Right.
I'm not going to wear a diaper, but I'm feeling that youthful enthusiasm of. I feel like I did back when I was first starting in this. We're really having so much fun making music and having adventures. It's pretty cool.
It's like a rebirth, and you're out with your friends.
Yeah, can't beat it.
ImmediateFamilyBand.com is where you can find all the info you need on the tour, the album, future events, and there's links to the videos as well. And if you go to Leland Sklar's Beard, you can get the book. And we're just going to play another tune. One last question I got to ask you, NPR has a tradition of educating. What is perhaps the best lesson that you learned from one of the many artists you've worked with, be it James Taylor or Peter or any of the guys? What is the one best lesson you've learned that you could pass on to young musicians?
Oh, God, I think the first word that comes to my mind is patience. You just take your time with things and work hard at your craft. Don't expect everything to happen overnight. But just, be real cognizant of the people around you and their needs and desires and try to work together as best you can. But it really requires patience. Being impatient in this business can really kick you in the butt.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Lee. I appreciate it. And again, I had the pleasure of shaking your hand when John Denver came to town many, many decades ago here at Star Plaza Theater. You were so nice to me. I was a young reporter and you were very cordial. I do appreciate that, which is why I really wanted to talk to you again.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and anytime you want, I'm here for you.
All right, thank you. Let's close out with one of my favorite songs right now off this album. Of course, that changes every time I play it. This is A Thing of the Past, and sometimes great. I feel like that. But Lee and the guys, they aren't. Media Family, new stuff. Check them out. This is Midwest Beats. I'm out of here. Stay safe, everyone. Adios.
Same colored hair. I know that she's not you, but I can't.